In Thomas J. Fleming's remarks, I can assure you that at the end of this long and rewarding day, we'll once again hear the L word. Lincoln, I mean. Tom is, of course, the editor of Chronicles. He was also a founding editor of Southern Partisan. It's always been interesting to me that a classicist by training should give over his career to the higher journalism, and I think that it's a function of the disjointedness of our times. As a matter of fact, it occurred to me the other day that there are some parallels here with a great American classicist of the 19th century, Basil Gildersleeve, who found his career interrupted by the late unpleasantness and having to go into mortal combat. I think that after several years of using his classical training in the academic world and as headmaster of a private school, Dr. Fleming was called to another form of combat. And as those of you who read Chronicles, I'm sure, understand well, he has never, ever backed away. Please welcome our final speaker, Thomas J. Fleming.
For any classical scholars out there, I want to tell them I have not actually abandoned my career and do publish regularly. And I would like to say thanks to Ken Cribb for taking credit for the choice of location. I was afraid someone would blame me. This is, of course, as Ken knows better than I, we are not now in Charleston, we are in North Charleston. When I was a student at the College of Charleston, not so far from here, we used to say that the North began in North Charleston. And if you smell the air and look at the shopping malls and the freeway and the hideous industrial development, you'll see what Yankee occupation is all about. In 1862, John Basil Turchin rode into Athens, Alabama with three regiments of Midwestern soldiers. Now, in point of fact, his name was Ivan Vasilevich Turchininov. And although he officially hailed from the dreary state that now goes by the name the Land of Lincoln, Turchin was a Cossack, formerly in the Russian Imperial Army, and he had been trained in the ways of Cossack officers from time immemorial. Colonel Turchin was offended by the demeanor of the people of Athens, both black and white, because they turned their backs upon his soldiers when they marched in and taunted him. So he turned over the town to a good old-fashioned pillaging, Cossack style, with the order to his second-in-command, "I close my eyes for 1 hour." Well, in that hour, his freedom fighters managed to steal everything that was not nailed down, and they did a good job of burning the rest. According to official records, the men raped every woman they could put their hands on, although these were mostly black, according to the official records. That, so it seems, was acceptable behavior for the officers and gentlemen of the Grand Army of the Republic. Local memories, however, do tell a different story. These men were non-discriminatory pillagers and left no one alone. But the women's families were too proud and too decent to reveal the degradation that they had undergone in that terrible hour. The Cossack colonel did not serve under Sherman. In the early days of the war, Sherman would have had him taken out and shot for disobeying orders. And later on, in his march through Georgia, Sherman might have cashiered him for not sacking the town more thoroughly. War is hell was Sherman's motto, and the mentally unstable general did the best he could to make it so. Turchin's horrified commander, Don Carlos Buell, convoked a court-martial chaired by a gentleman and scholar and the first honorable Republican president, James Garfield. Overruling the vote of his officers, Garfield condemned Turchin for his war crimes, but the Cossack had friends in high places, Illinois high places. And once these friends had explained matters to the great emancipator, after all these women were mostly black, President Lincoln not only pardoned Turchin for his crimes, but arranged for his promotion to the rank of Brigadier General. Now, those who wish to regard Lincoln as a secular saint have trouble explaining his decision to overlook the Athens episode. But this is the same president who authorized Sherman's march, initiating a war against civilian population. And he did not repudiate General Beast Butler's order in New Orleans to treat all women who were rude to federal troops as if they were prostitutes. Indeed, Lincoln's cavalier attitude toward the sufferings of Southern women reminds some of us of Stalin, who made jokes about the Red Army's wholesale rape of Yugoslav women at the end of World War II. And Mila Vangelis tells an amusing story of Stalin grabbing his wife, Mrs. Gilas, and kissing her and saying, "Now you're going to accuse me of rape, I suppose." Some Southerners have been tempted to regard Lincoln as a modern Stalin or even Hitler. But to those who knew him well, as his old law partner William Herndon, the reason for his callousness was plain. Lincoln was neither a saint nor a monster, only a shrewd politician, a cool man, as in Herndon's words, who could not afford to cashier an influential Illinoisan, no matter what his alleged crime. A more ardent seeker after office never existed, was the summary judgment of Senator Lyman Trumbull, who knew him well. A courthouse scoundrel, in the words of another prominent fellow Republican. The most prominent men of Lincoln's own party, including members of his cabinet, treated him with scant respect. Seward, Stanton, Chase, Horace Greeley, all expressed themselves very frankly on this. To many of his contemporaries, North and South, Lincoln seemed to be a Macbeth without a conscience, a political opportunist willing to wade through a sea of blood in order to fulfill his political ambitions. Now, our late friend Mel Bradford might not have chosen such strong language, at least not in public. But his criticisms of Lincoln were nonetheless severe, severe enough to earn the hatred both of the official left and of that wing of the official right that are still leftists at heart. I don't have to quote Mel on Lincoln, I think, for you. We've heard a good deal of that today. What most attracted Professor Bradford's attention was the Lincolnian rhetoric, part messianic demagoguery, part personal invective. In one of his last published essays, Professor Bradford describes Mr. Lincoln's political technique of ad hominem attack against such rivals as Stephen Douglas. Quote, "That this kind of politics would destroy the Union did not worry Mr. Lincoln. Instead, he scrawled in envy little meditations on his own humble state and the little giant's fame. He burned with ambition to have a name and found in vilification his modus vivendi. Once he was finished in his career, he had left behind him a trail of blood, an emancipation under the worst possible circumstances, and a political example which continues to injure the republic which he did so much to undermine. It is at our peril that we continue to reverence his name." But reverence for Lincoln is one of the few remaining pieties of American public life. Washington and Jefferson were, after all, slave owners, and the good New Englanders like John Adams, there is such a species, were hardly friends of equality. What Lincoln's defenders can never seem to understand is both the revolutionary program of his politics, dating from his very first speeches, and his radical innovation in the conduct of the war he waged against a civilized people. On the former point, the political revolution that Lincoln staged, leftist historians like James McPherson have been more than candid. And when our great and good friend Mel Bradford attempted to say as much in a review commissioned by a leading conservative journal of opinion, he was spiked. Not an unusual experience for any real conservatives left in the United States. Now, for all the recently published analysis of Abraham Lincoln's presidency, the allegations of war crimes, so common 100 years ago, seem to evade scholarly attention, although there are families right here in Charleston County whose farms and homes were burned wantonly by the invading army, in some cases several years after the war was over. The most controversial aspect of Mel Bradford's career was his insistence that the nation, all of this nation, would someday have to come to terms with the evil that had been done in the name of human rights and with the apparent blessing of the 16th president. To understand how a country founded on states' rights, family autonomy, freedom of religion, and individual liberty at home, and a policy of laissez-faire abroad, turned into a nation whose chief characteristics are state socialism at home and humanitarian violence abroad, we must come face to face both with the legacy of the founders and with what that legacy suffered at the hands of Lincoln and his successors. No one has seen this more clearly than M.E. Bradford, whose work has revealed to us both the complex reality of the founding of this nation and the terrible facts of its bloody transformation in the 1860s. The curious fact is not that a few Southerners and a few Yankees have begun to regard Lincoln as a Julius Caesar without military talent, a Cromwell without religion, a Robespierre without virtue, but that it has been taken us so long to begin overturning his larger-than-life reputation, much as the liberated Poles and Russians have toppled the statues of Stalin. When I was a boy attending General William Moultrie High School across the Cooper River in Mount Pleasant, I do not recall hearing any anti-Lincoln sentiments, either from my teachers or from my classmates. Of course the South was right to secede, they said. Reconstruction was one of the most terrible evils that one civilized people had ever inflicted upon another. But Lincoln, the argument ran, was an essentially good, if misguided, statesman who would never have permitted the pillaging and humiliation inflicted under the protection of Yankee bayonets. Despite the frank accounts of Lincoln given by his friends, the hagiography began early. For example, Herndon's memoirs were expurgated in later editions to take out page after page of critical remarks on Lincoln. A free people does not turn its leaders into plaster saints or colossal statues, but the new model America that Lincoln inspired, Wilson mobilized, and Franklin Roosevelt organized is a classic example of a propaganda regime based on Hitler's theory of the great lie. That is why we have saddled ourselves with all the trumpery paraphernalia of aggressive nationalism, flag reverence, pledges of allegiance, and the monstrous imperial architecture of Washington, D.C., buildings that might have been designed by Albert Speer on a bad day. There was a good aspect to the new nationalism, and that was the desire for national unity in the aftermath of three decades of sectionalism, war, and occupation. Reconstruction was over by 1876, and by the turn of the century, most Americans were ready to let bygones be bygones. A son of Charles Francis Adams gave and repeated a famous eulogy for Robert E. Lee, and fictional accounts of the Old South became bestsellers in the North, not just the sentimental writings of Thomas Nelson Page, but also a variety of books. The greatest classic of American literature, an affectionate, though not uncritical, story of two poor Southern boys, one black, one white, was written by a Confederate deserter who spent his life coming to terms with himself as a Southerner posing as a Confederate Yankee. And in the next generation, the Southern Literary Factory turned out book after book celebrating the South and lamenting its sufferings. Books like Thomas Dixon's The Klansman and The Leopard Spots explained the horrors of Reconstruction to Northerners. And if they could not read novels, because Yankees are not big readers, they could go to see the movie version, The Birth of a Nation, which was the first masterpiece of American filmmaking. But a film which, by the way, can't be shown at Library of Congress and elsewhere. Later generations would weep over the burning of Atlanta and the sufferings of Scarlett O'Hara and her family. Although now when the movie is shown on television, it must be prefaced by a disclaimer, the sort of thing that usually attached to pornography. Perhaps the most significant work in all this revisionism was a now-forgotten novel by Philadelphian Owen Wister. Wister is most famous, of course, for the novel The Virginian, a book that helped to establish the legend of the West. The Virginian was put together right here in Charleston after some sketches which Wister had published. And the city inspired his other important book, Lady Baltimore, in which Wister laid the foundations for the literary reconciliation of North and South. "Oh, hang slavery, hang the war," exclaims Wister's Northern hero. "Of course we have had a family quarrel, but we were a family once, and a fine one too. We knew each other, we visited each other, we wrote letters, sent presents, kept up relations. We, in short, coherently joined hands from one generation to another. The fibers of the sons tingled with the current from their fathers back and back to the old beginnings, to Plymouth and Roanoke and Rip Van Winkle." By the way, if you have not read this book, there is a new edition published by J.F. Sanders of Tennessee with a splendid editorial introduction. And Mel was the literary editor for this whole series of Southern reprints, which I would draw to your attention. The first edition of Lady Baltimore was issued in 1905. And by the time of the second edition in 1928, which by the way is the same year of the last real prayer book of American Anglicanism, Wister's hopes for a new nationalism rooted in the mutual respect of North and South was by then a reality. The nation's history textbooks routinely portrayed the sectional struggle as the South's fault, but the Southern generals were made the heroes of the war, and Reconstruction was depicted as an unmitigated evil inflicted by fanatics and criminals. Part of the price for this compromise was the South's acquiescence in the Lincoln myth. Now, no American scholar did more for the sectional reconciliation than Mel Bradford. First, by his vigorous advocacy of Southern literature and by his acute interpretation of the founding, even more by his sympathetic portraits of such distinguished Northern founders as Theodore Sedgwick and Sam Adams, all already alluded to by Bill Dennis, and by the attention he lavished on Northern ratifying conventions. He was, in a sense, an honorary Yankee who appreciated New England more than most New Englanders. Although I would not want to read too much into this, Professor Bradford had beautiful manners, and he would not have gone to Boston, for example, to condemn the Adamses. All his life, Mel Bradford breathed the atmosphere of reconciliation in which most living Southerners were reared, an atmosphere that lasted down to the end of the 1950s. But in the past 40 years, that atmosphere has been poisoned by a series of what Southerners can only regard as betrayals, by Dwight Eisenhower, who reintroduced the tactics of Reconstruction, by the Kennedy brothers, who backed up the plagiarizing, womanizing traitor who has replaced Lincoln as our great national hero, by the scores and scores of films, books, and television shows that routinely portray Southerners as subhuman bigots, by the rudeness displayed by supposed conservative scholars against Bradford and other Southerners, and most recently by the relentless attacks on the stars and bars and the monuments set up to honor Confederate heroes. It is the same old tired theme of slavery that we have to hear of, from leftists who routinely apologize for Stalin, from liberals who dragged us into two terrible wars in this century, from Northerners whose ancestors got rich on the slave trade and exploited their own native-born and immigrant white workers in a manner that horrified Christian Southerners. Of course Southerners did things to be ashamed of. We all do. But nothing to justify either the barbaric war that was inflicted upon them in defiance of the Constitution, and nothing to justify the endless hypocritical sermons by people who would do much better, as Henry David Thoreau suggested, put their own houses in order. "We were a family once," said Owen Wister. And through the efforts of people like Wister, we tried to become a family again. I fear, however, that we are now on the edge of a second great divorce, and that Northern conservatives, who should be doing everything in their power to keep this marriage going, are acting more like the marriage counselor who tell wives to get out of that destructive relationship as soon as possible. Apart from a few people like Pat Buchanan and Ollie North, the reaction of most Northern conservatives to the attack on the Confederate flag is indifference, if not hostility, to the flag itself. Worse, our Northern brethren like Jack Kemp and Bill Bennett and the editors of the Wall Street Journal have tried to turn the so-called Dr. King into a litmus test for legitimate conservatism. And if any American is so old-fashioned that he objects to King's personal vices and dishonesty, the riots he engineered, the treason he preached in telling American troops in Vietnam not to fight for a white government against persons of color, well, then we are shunned and denounced by the same right-thinking conservatives who attacked Professor Bradford. There was a time, not so long ago, when Southerners were content to accept an honorable status as second-class citizens in the United States, when Southern agrarians like Richard Weaver could find good things to say about Lincoln's rhetoric. But for the past several decades, Northerners have been stirring up a Southern hornet's nest, and the enthusiastic response to the announcement that a Southern League had been formed to defend Southern honor and Southern rights is an early indication of what is to come. Anybody who wishes to stay for the meeting, by the way, it's held in this hotel this evening. Southerners have long memories, even if they also have good manners, and prefer not to exploit the suffering of their ancestors. Not long ago, I was talking with a Southern scholar who is head of one of the most useful conservative organizations in this country. He told me of a trip he had made as a boy with his grandfather back to the old man's hometown, Athens, Alabama. "Tom," he said, "those people just hated Yankees, like no one I have never met in my life." You'd never heard the story of Colonel Turchin, and when I told him, he understood at once. And he also understood the reticence of his kinfolk. I guarantee you the people of Athens, Alabama still do remember, and you can still read articles in Alabama newspapers about the sack of Athens. Now I'm speaking to you here today not as a Southern apologist, but as an observer of the American scene, as a man born in Wisconsin, as someone who has divided his life between the South and the Midwest. All that Southerners want now, as Jeff Davis said, is to be let alone. Even the dictator Lincoln promised malice toward none and charity toward all. And when the day comes that a Southern conservative can discuss states' rights, the 14th Amendment, or the courage of his ancestors without a half-baked professor in Claremont calling him a racist or accusing Jeff Davis and John C. Calhoun of being Nazis, when that happens, most of us will cheerfully bite our tongue when the subject of Father Abraham comes up. But until that happy day, I fear, the Southern motto will have to be, never forget.